Last April, the Hamilton Spectator published a series called Code Red. Almost a year later, people are still talking about it. And that's because, for many, the results revealed pretty shocking truths. The series mapped health outcomes and socio-demographic data demonstrating huge health disparities in our city. Among the findings was a 21-year life expectancy difference between two neighboring Hamilton communities. The author of the series, Steve Buist, spoke at McMaster last Thursday along with other community leaders at an event hosted by the McMaster Community Poverty Initiative. Today on the Health Justice Radio Collective, we hear highlights from that talk.
Listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3.
Hi there, we're back. My name is Nikki Bosnoff, and on the board is Eric Brown, and you're listening to the Health Justice Radio Collective. We're going to get right into it. Here is a segment. Speaking is Steve Buist, who's a journalist with the Hamilton Spectator.
These disparities are things that I think really captured the attention of the public. And I think it's because a lot of this information, while it may seem, now that you see it and you think about it, it may seem sort of instinctively obvious to you. At the time, I don't think people gave it a lot of thought. This whole notion of the social determinants of health, I don't think people have really given it a lot of thought until you get kind of hit over the head with it, and then you kind of go, oh yeah, that makes some sense, right? And why is that? I'll tell you why. Because in Canada, what do we have? Universal health care. We have universal, freely accessible health care, right? And so I think that people have assumed that because we have universal, freely available health care here in Canada, that means that we have equal health care, right? And by extension, if we have freely available, universally accessible health care, and we think that it leads to equal health care, we think that that leads to equal health, or at least equal health within a relatively small range, except for those people who smoke or whatever. And I think what this series showed everyone was that there is nothing equal about the health of people that live in Hamilton. So, let's see, some of the other things that we looked at. Low birth weight babies. So low birth weight babies, for those of you who know anything about it, that's a baby that's born at less than 2,500 grams. A low birth weight baby, I'm sorry to say, will be a drain on society probably for the rest of their life, which has huge cost implications. So there's all sorts of work trying to reduce the rates of low birth weight babies. In Hamilton, we found that there were 7 neighborhoods out of the 130 that had a low birth weight baby rate, I'm sorry to say, a low birth weight baby rate of more than 20%. There was one neighborhood that had a low birth weight baby rate of 47%. Okay. The rate of low birth weight babies in sub-Saharan Africa, according to the World Health Organization, is 15%. So we have neighborhoods here in Hamilton that are worse than sub-Saharan Africa. I don't know about you, I find that shocking. Acute care hospital bed use, that was one of the things that we could look at. So acute care hospital bed use, hugely expensive to the system. According to the Ministry of Health, a day in an acute care bed, so that's, you know, traditional, you get sent to the hospital and something's wrong with you, not the emergency room. The cost of an acute care hospital bed in Hamilton is about $1,300 a day. So obviously, the less time that you can get people spending in hospitals, the better it is. We had one neighborhood where it was an inner city, lower inner city neighborhood where the acute care hospital bed use was 729 days per 1,000 people between the ages of 16 and 69. So basically adults. 729 acute care bed days per 1,000 people. In one of the wealthy Flamborough neighborhoods, so 729 46. The difference of 16 times from top to bottom. That's hugely expensive. So let's convert a little bit of this to cost. So when you know that an acute care hospital bed is about $1,300 a day, the Ministry of Health says that an ER visit in Hamilton is about $260 every time you step through the door. An ambulance trip is $750 approximately. You can start calculating some global costs for how much it costs us as a society when people are in emergency rooms and hospitals. So I could take the stats that we have, translate those into dollar values. So if you took the five neighborhoods at the top of the list in terms of the total costs, when you added up acute care bed use, emergency room visits, etc., you take the top five neighborhoods and add them together, it comes out to $38.3 million for the time that we left that. Five neighborhoods, $38.3 million. If you took the five neighborhoods at the bottom that were the least expensive, that cost the least to us, so $38.3 million for the five most expensive, the five least expensive, $4.3 million. That's $34 million difference between the top five and the bottom five. Now, I don't know about you, but surely there's got to be a better way to spend $34 million than just having hospitals that are basically revolving doors. So, we looked at some of these health factors, and then we looked at some of the socioeconomic factors, and guess what? Same sort of patterns that we were seeing on the health maps are showing up on the socioeconomic maps. So, we had a neighborhood in Hamilton, according to the 2006 census, there was one neighborhood in Hamilton right in front of the steel mills where the average value of a house was $87,000 and change. That's the cost of a pretty good Lexus or Mercedes SUV. So we had a neighborhood where the average house value was $87,000. At the other end, at the other extreme, out in Flamborough, wealthiest part of Flamborough, the average house value was just under $500,000. This is all in the same city. Okay? You can sell your average priced house in that Flamborough neighborhood and buy five houses in the cheapest neighborhood and still have enough money left over to buy Mercedes. The two school boards decided to play ball with us, and they both gave us their high school dropout rates. And we created a map for that. We were able to show that in the worst neighborhood, again, in the lower inner city, the high school dropout rate was 267 students per 1,000 students. So more than one in four kids is a high school dropout. 267 in the worst neighborhood. In the best neighborhood, again, in Flamborough, 267 per 1,000, 3 per 1,000. That's a difference of 89 times from top to bottom. Staggering disparity. Education. So, there's one neighborhood in Hamilton where 40% of the adults in that neighborhood don't have a high school diploma. There's one neighborhood over by the Center Mall where there are 1,375 adults between the ages of 25 and 64, so people that are through the school system. 1,375 adults, 10 of them have a university degree. This is in a city that has McMaster University, Mohawk College, Redeemer, 10 out of 1,375 have a post-secondary diploma. So, if you were to take the 130 neighborhoods that make up these maps, the top 44 neighborhoods with the highest rates of people living in poverty are all found in the former city of Hamilton. Top 44. So you have to go to number 45 before you get outside the old city of Hamilton. So you want to talk about concentrated poverty. If you were to take a look at the narrow corridor that goes from Queen Street to Sherman Avenue, from King Street to Cannon, so that little narrow strip, there's about 13,000 people that live in that little strip. 42% of them live in poverty. That's concentrated poverty. We have one neighborhood in the lower central city, one of the worst ones on the overall map, where almost 70% of the children under the age of 18 live in poverty. I'm a father, I can tell you that breaks my heart. So, when you look at some of these factors, and you start looking at some of these maps, and you start comparing them and putting them together, you see that all of a sudden there's lots of interconnections between things. So, here's an example. Let's say we took the psychiatric emergency room visits, right? If you took the 10 neighborhoods that have the highest rate of psychiatric emergency visits, they would form almost a perfect square right around Hamilton's downtown. It certainly doesn't help the perception that downtown Hamilton is a scary place to be. But if you took those top 10 neighborhoods with the top psychiatric emergency room visit rates, you'd also find that 7 of them would be in the top 10 for people that have the highest rates of no family physician. So you start to see that all of these things become interconnected. So that's important to think about, because when you start thinking about things like, you know, why are there high rates of emergency room visit rates? High rates of emergency room visits in certain neighborhoods. And it's easy to say, well, you know, people just abuse the system. They're not very smart. They don't know any better. But really, when you start thinking about all of the factors that are in play, you need to remember that people will choose the path of least resistance. Okay? And so if people are showing up at the hospital or in an emergency room, it's not because they want to abuse the system. It's because we haven't provided them with a better alternative. And as Neil said when we started talking about this, he said, you know, there may be a clash of 6 or 7 factors that causes somebody to go to an emergency room, but have nothing to do with the fact that they're trying to abuse the system. So you start thinking about it. Maybe it's a single mom that has 3 kids. She has no partner for support. She has no car. She has no transportation. She may not speak English very well. She may have a child with asthma. She doesn't have a family doctor. There's no clinic around her that's open at 9 o'clock at night. She has a child that's having an asthma attack. Where does she go? What can she do? Maybe she had to make a choice between buying asthma medication for her son or buying a loaf of bread for the other kids. I know that sounds dramatic, but these are the kinds of choices that people need to face every day. So they did what was the best solution for them at that time. They had no other alternatives. They saw that ADH on top of the building, and that's where they went. So until we start providing them with better alternatives, that's what's going to happen.
That was the Hamilton Spectator's Steve Buist. He's the author of the Code Red series. We heard some pretty shocking disparities talked about there. And after his talk on Thursday, a number of community leaders responded. Claire Freeman is the executive director of Interval House, which is a shelter for women who experience violence. She has a master's of social work from York University. And here's what she had to say after Steve's talk.
Thank you very much. I'm really pleased with what Steve has done with highlighting the issues in the city of Hamilton. But just to let you know, I come from the East End, probably the one with the most downwind from Stelco. And I just like to say this. When I was a kid living down on Woodward Avenue, we had lots of trucks going by and not a lot of trees there. And I remember every morning waking up and smelling the sulfur in the air. And what's really interesting about it now, when I travel down on Barton Street or Burlington Street and I smell the sulfur in the air, I actually think that I'm home, right? I actually feel comforted by that, which is kind of scary in a way. But you know what I know about folks that live where I used to live is that there's strong resiliency in communities. There are leaders within the community. There are sharing within the communities. And when you hear sometimes social services or folks with lots of means talk about giving people who are living without means life skills, I have to say, you must go live down there and see the amazing life skills that folks who are living with little can do. One of the great things that you can learn from folks that are living in poverty is that they can tell you all of these things about the systems that don't work. So when people are actually trying to figure out what to make things work, go talk to the people. They will tell you when social services don't meet their needs. They will tell you when the hospital doesn't work. And they can tell you what it's like having your children and standing at the bus stop and not having enough money to get on the bus, and it's in the middle of the night, and your child is whining because they don't want to go with their other sibling to the hospital, and you're supposed to be, you know, good, calm, and collected, and dealing with all that stress. So people who live in poverty deal with lots of stress, and they know how. I'm specifically going to talk about the other issue about poverty, and that it's gendered. Poverty is not, you know, just kind of a blanket thing. When you look at those Code Red areas, you will see that there are lots of women living down there, and there are lots of women with children. Single-parent women make up a large portion down there. And what I sometimes say to folks, because I took economics, that children, and this is speaking from an economics hat, not from an emotional hat, the biggest cost to women in terms of living in poverty and staying in poverty is actually having children. That's not a very popular thing to say, but we have a system that really doesn't accommodate for raising children in a way that we can make lives better for their parents, such as universal health care. Universal child care would certainly help a lot of folks with less income to live better lives. It would give them more opportunities. The other thing I know about living in without income, I could say, or little income, is that you don't get a lot of say about how your services are delivered. When you have money, you have problems too. You have drug addicts in your house. You have people who sometimes struggle with mental illness. You have sometimes people with gambling problems, and you also might have family violence in your home. The difference for people with money compared to people with limited money is that you can hide your problems. Wealth actually gives you privacy and allows you privacy. So let me tell you a little bit about the women who sometimes come into our shelter who don't have any needs. This is what it's like for them. They have to tell us everything about their life, and then we have to then go to try to find them housing. There isn't enough housing in the city of Hamilton, and some of that housing is very dense areas. And yes, they can choose the kind of areas that they live in that are all within the social housing units, but they, again, are highly dense areas. So even when you pick the mountain, you're usually picking one of the most dense populated areas on the mountain. So they get two choices of where they get to live if it comes up. But before they even get accepted on that, because they're given what's called a priority status because they're escaping violence, it basically means that for some people, they think they jump the queue, because if you're not in the special priority list, then you have to wait 2 to 3 years for social housing. So when you get this special priority, you basically can get housed within maybe 4 to 5 weeks, depending on how you left your residence. So when women come in, we have to get them to fill out forms that basically give all kinds of personal information. And then the city folks, city housing folks, get to decide whether the violence that you've experienced in your life is worthy or truthful enough for you to get housing. I'm not putting down the city housing folks because they're a limited amount and they're trying to do the best they can, but that's the impact of not having money to argue that you deserve to be housed in a nice place and free from violence. It also means that when you leave sometimes the shelter, or if you're living in poverty, is that you have to stand in line for food. And when you talk about, you know, breakfast programs, and you talk about, you know, the dollar that some people might have to pay, that's a real reality for folks. People do skip out on their medications for their children. They get fearful when the school is talking about school trips. When their kids start talking about wanting to join sports, that's a real fearful place for parents. And so sometimes children can't afford to do all the programs that they want. And when parents basically talk back to systems, they often get told that they should be grateful. That's the other thing about living in poverty. You're always told, either directly or indirectly, that you somehow have done it wrong. that somehow you got yourself down to this poverty space because you're not like the rest of the good people in the world. And that's simply not true. And I just like to say that poverty is a part of capitalism, and I know I shouldn't be speaking about those things, but the reality is that capitalism exists so few in the top have a lot and the majority needs to sit on the bottom. That's how it works. But it doesn't mean that if you're poor that we have to treat those with limited income in such a terrible way that we do. When Harris came in 1995, he cut our social benefits 19%. We've had a liberal government, and I'm not talking about who you need to vote for, but we have a government that never restored that. And if you think about having your income cut 19% in 1995 and never having it restored, and then you look at how costs have gone up for you if you have an income and how hard that is for you to keep making a living, it's twice as hard, twice as stressful on young families with not much. But what I want to say, right, because my time's up, about the gendered issue is that women who live in poverty, it's also not a homogeneous group. We have different communities, different racialized communities that live in higher proportion of poverty than do others, and certainly the Aboriginal community is one of the highest groups who live in poverty. And they're also, especially for women, they're one of the largest groups that make up the criminal population. And criminalizing of women is actually a straight co-relationship around poverty, and sometimes racism as well. When you look at women who are actually criminalized, what you find is that the most of the women who are criminalized for issues of fraud. Fraud and stealing, not for violent crimes. And I used to do some training for the probation and parole, and one day, probation and parole people were all kind of chuckling, and they were talking about what was the month that most women were charged in for offenses. And if none of you know this, it is actually August. I was actually quite surprised. Why August? Back to school. Most women are actually charged with stealing for their children. And you know what? We need to talk about those issues. We need to talk about the issues of race, ability, orientation, transgender, when we talk about the issues of poverty. We can't just make it one homogeneous group, but we also cannot leave out the fact that it is women who are living there most, and seniors, and those with acute mental illness who can't get the kind of treatment that they need and the kind of care they need. So thank you.
That was Claire Freeman, and she's the executive director of Interval House, which is a shelter for women experiencing violence. I think there were some very profound statements in that talk, and she was responding to Steve Buist, who's the author of the Hamilton Spectator's Code Red series. Lorraine Chapman also responded that night. She's the director of mental health programs for Good Shepherd Centers, and she's also the director of the Homes Program, one of the biggest programs in the province, and if not the best in the country, for keeping people housed. Here's what she had to say.
Poverty affects housing, food, relationships, hygiene, clothing, mood, hope, quality of life, opportunities, choices, locus of control, personal and social power, physical health, sense of security, safety, and self-esteem. How can anyone living in poverty have good mental health? All of your energy goes on survival. How do I get through today? It's hard to make plans. It's hard to set goals. It's hard to feel some degree of self-esteem and sense of personal power because of your dependency on others. It's the waiting in lines, it's the asking for social assistance, it's the requesting subsidies, it's the whole demeaning process of having to hustle for everything you need. If you think about people that are poor and have mental illness, persons with mental illness have an extremely high rate of unemployment and dependence on social assistance. There's a high degree of stigma in our society about mental illness. People with mental illness die on average, just people with mental illness, not even factoring in extra issues about poverty, people with mental illness die on average of 25 years earlier than mainstream population. There's high rates of what they call metabolic disorder, cardiac, diabetes, cholesterol issues. People are struggling with the side effects of medication, which makes it difficult to cope and to survive and to do basic kind of getting through life. There's usually a high incidence for many people of using alcohol and drugs to cope. The issues about medication for people with mental illness are, it's not an exact science. It's much more trial and error than physical health issues. There's issues of discrimination in housing because of perceived difference about the way people look, behave, symptoms they may have. People are at risk for being criminalized, incarcerated for behaviors or symptoms that aren't fully understood, and people don't have that kind of access to the mental health system. People may not have resources to have a telephone or transportation, things that everybody needs access to in order to get the things they need. It affects your ability to make and keep appointments. So people are cut off waiting lists. People are cut off services because they can't get to them. They can't be reached for appointments. They get dumped off waiting lists for housing because people can't reach them or they can't keep their status updated. People lose housing with longer-term admissions to hospitals or no supports to keep housing when they're unwell. People go to shelters, streets, couch surfing, unsafe or inadequate housing. They're preyed on by other people. The Wellesley Institute says good housing is good health. Poor housing is poor health. Problems in housing affect people's sleep, associates, their sense of safety, their storage of medications. There's a trap of no money, no address. No address, no money. If you're not sure about that, try applying for social assistance. If people have a mental illness and are in hospital, they don't have much choice in housing. They may have lost their housing, they may have lost their possessions when they've been admitted to hospital. They have very few choices when they come out, when the hospitals are busy to discharge people and discharge people quickly. Often they get discharged to what we call residential care facilities, proliferation of second-level lodging homes in this particular city. It means you have very little access to money, $132 a month. You have even less control over your environment, you have less money. Once you're in shelters or in residential care facilities, those systems are paid backwards. When the rest of the world, like us, pay rent, we have to pay forward, and it doesn't work. People can't get the money they need to put down payments on apartments and have them kept for them. Once you're in any kind of custodial situation with a mental illness, you're obviously very poor. It's assumed that not just because it was the default position when you left hospital that you went to that residential care or custodial facility, it's assumed you need that much care and you can't function in independent housing, no matter what your skills or abilities are. So what do we need? We need a national housing policy so that every person in this country has the right to safe, affordable, and adequate housing. We need to be able to have people to be able to afford housing so they can afford food, they can afford the other necessities in life. We need higher levels of social assistance. We need more supportive and subsidized housing. We need more opportunities to give people hope, power, participation in our society. Because one of the sad things is the issues of citizenship, participation, having your voice heard are what's taken from people, sometimes by mental illness, but more often by poverty. We need peer support linkages that help people believe they can recover, become part of the world again, and can make contributions to society. We need less barriers and more opportunities.
Okay, that was Lorraine Chapman, and she's the Director of Mental Health Programs at the Good Shepherd. Today, on today's episode, we heard segments from the McMaster Community Poverty Initiative's lecture last Thursday. Thanks for joining us. My name is Nikki, and on the board was Eric Brown, and you are listening to the Health Justice Radio Collective.